From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. The rules of the internet have changed.
With a charter price guarantee,
Verizon truly is America's most reliable network.
Switch to Cox.
The fastest, is here. Introducing the new Comcast high-speed internet.
We will explain what net neutrality means before we explain why its repeal might hurt people in rural areas. First, though, welcome to the first work week of 2018. We recently asked about the worst jobs you've ever had, and here are your first thoughts. We hear it from Ed Donnelly in Atlanta.
I worked one day selling AT&T U-verse subscriptions door-to-door. It was one of the coldest days I remember in Atlanta's history. My feet were blue when I got home, but the thing that did it for me was a house with a Confederate battle flag in the window from which a dog was released to, perhaps not two, but it did harass me and the other African-American gentleman.
Hi, my name is Mark Parkinson, calling from Rome, Georgia. I went to work as a car salesman for one day. And I just couldn't do it.
Hi, this is Chad. I actually went for what was deemed a working interview at a rabbit farm, which entailed pretty much just shoveling rabbit poop all day, and no one was called back. So basically, I think they just needed their rabbit poop shoveled.
That's a bad job. We would love to hear about yours, the worst job you've ever had. You know how to reach us. You can call it 404-500-9457 or find us on Twitter. It's at OST Talk. Just remember, we might feature your comments on the show. Georgia lawmakers convene next week. And while there were many discussions about the new federal tax bill and how it might benefit the politicians that voted for it, there are similar debates going on here in Georgia. The Center for Public Integrity and the Associated Press recently analyzed financial disclosure reports from state legislators nationwide, and they found many examples of politicians who've used their power to benefit their own interests. Liz White is a reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. Hi there, Liz.
Hi, Celeste.
And James Salzer covers state politics for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. About to get quite busy, James.
Yes, we are.
So, Liz, let's begin with this. This is something that is called self-elected self-interest. And it's fair to say it's common nationwide, is it not?
Yeah, most state legislatures are part-time in the United States, and many of them pay very little, similar to Georgia. And as a result, the state lawmakers, citizen legislators, need outside employment, and that just in and of itself breeds opportunities for conflicts of interest.
So, James, how do politicians here in Georgia see this? Do they ever recuse themselves from these votes?
Once in a great while, there is one legislator in particular who they actually named a rule after because it was so common that he would exempt himself from a vote for a conflict of interest. But the reality is that the rules of the House and Senate make almost nothing a conflict of interest. It's very, very hard to, literally, you have to have a bill that only helps you or your business.
Like you by name.
You know, yeah. You know, obviously you're not put your name on it, but it would have to be something that says this bill will benefit me and my company. And to the exclusion of other people in that business, in the industry.
So, Liz, how lenient, then, do you think Georgia's laws are when it comes to this? Did you find evidence that politicians are regularly voting on bills and laws that might benefit them?
Well, what we did was we got all of the disclosures for the state legislatures in the United States. So Michigan, Vermont, Idaho didn't have them at the time, but for 6,933 legislators, we did get them, and we combed through them, and we found many examples of legislators sponsoring bills or voting for things that benefited them or their businesses or their employers, and kind of combed through that and chose some examples to highlight in our reporting, which you can see at publicintegrity.org. We didn't choose to highlight any in Georgia in particular, but we definitely saw some while we were reporting. And I would say in a lot of states like Georgia that have part-time legislatures, it is very common for things to go unnoticed and for people to sit on committees where they're regularly making decisions that affect their business, their line of work, how much they might take home at the end of the day in a paycheck. And that's fairly common.
And in fact, you've created a searchable library so I can go in there and just put in Georgia and find my lawmakers, right?
Right. You can stick in your address at apps.publicintegrity.org/disclosure, and you'll see your state lawmakers, 2015 financial disclosure, or any other state lawmakers you want to look up.
But James, it's almost a running joke here in Georgia how voters will continue to vote for politicians who've even been found guilty of financial misconduct in some cases. There is Eugene Talmadge, who was, accused pretty credibly of stealing tens of thousands of dollars, and he said famously, "Yeah, I stole it, but I stole it for you." Right?
Yeah.
How much do you expect this kind of thing bothers Georgia voters?
It really depends on the district. I mean, I'm sure there are examples where people were thrown out for some of this, but I remember in the early 2000s. One of the most powerful legislators in the state got indicted on over 100 charges of malfeasance, financial malfeasance. And he was reelected, he won election. He had lost an election, and he won an election under indictment and eventually went to trial and was convicted and sent to prison for 10 years. But his voters said, he's not been convicted, he's not been convicted of any crime. A lot of these examples. I help oversee the capital team at my JC and Politically Georgia, and we commonly look at the financial disclosure reports when we see bills that are filed that look like it's going to help a specific industry. I mean, I kind of emphasize that with my reporters, and I do it myself. A lot of the stuff that, in this report, you can get those same reports in Georgia. If you don't want to get it from that group, you can get them at the State Ethics Commission because they have the same reports filed there.
Well, if you're just joining us, I'm speaking with James Salzer of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and Liz White, who's a reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. But Liz, what kind of trends, the Center for Public Integrity, this is the kind of work that is your mission. That's what the CPI does. And have you seen any trends in how closely people, voters, are paying attention to these issues and whether they care?
That's a good question. Unfortunately, I think from what just paying attention to politics these days, I think political engagement is fairly low. Most people don't even know who their state lawmakers are. And so I would say it would be pretty unusual for this to become a major issue in a state. I think what we wanted to really highlight with our reporting was just how pervasive it is, sometimes really egregious too. For example, we found the rare coin dealer who got the rare coin tax break through the Louisiana legislature twice, and we found a North Dakota lawmaker who had who has repeatedly opposed an ethics commission in North Dakota, sponsoring bills that include a lot of extra funding for colleges that happen to be his customers. In some cases, to your average person, it seems like a fairly substantial issue, but state legislatures don't see it that way, and they make their own rules, and so that's what we're left with.
And Liz, there's often questions about how somebody goes into Congress, and I'm talking about the federal Congress, and they're worth $200,000 maybe, and 8 years later, they come out and they're worth $1.5 million. Can we draw a line between this elected self-interest that you're reporting on and the net worth of our elected politicians?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, even Congress has rules against employment while you're serving.
Even Congress?
Yeah, they have pretty strict rules since the 1970s on moonlighting and outside employment. Where state legislatures are designed to be citizen legislatures, they want it that way. So, and there are some benefits to citizen legislatures too. There's, I think it's a convincing argument to say that It's nice to have for lawmakers to have real world experience to get out there and really know what it is like from day to day to try to earn a paycheck. In addition, you know, some of these lawmakers, there's in some states high turnover, like you need people with experience in certain industries to be able to regulate them, that kind of thing. But anyway, yeah, that's a good question. I think we saw some examples. For example, in Rhode Island, there was one lawmaker who specifically said on his website, he was a DUI lawyer, and he said, you know, you should hire me because I literally wrote the law. That's what his website said. And there are a couple other examples like that, too, where people are using their status as a lawmaker to specifically advertise for their outside employment.
So, James, there's no desire, as far as I know, in Georgia to employ a full-time legislature.
No.
Right.
No.
So pretty much all the legislators have either their own business or are still employed.
Yeah, the Speaker Ralston recently, when we were talking at the newspaper, related it's kind of an old story, but that a legislator from North Georgia was asked during an interview, excuse me, who serves in the legislature, and he essentially said rich people, retirees, and people who are broke, and that's essentially, you know, that there are a lot of retirees, there are a lot of people who are in business. And people who are broke are people who are trying to live off what's in the legislature. And there aren't that many of those. But by and large, people are in business or they work for businesses that are willing to let them off during the session. But there are, you know, many lawyers, many people in the insurance industry who regulate the insurance industry and their committee. The lawyers all make all the laws write all the laws that affect their industry, affect the judiciary. So they're... you know, it's incredibly common for that to be kind of the theme.
And that seems to be the problem, Liz, because how difficult would it be if every legislator were to recuse themselves from bills that benefited them in some way? We'd have a lot of absences, right?
Yeah, that is one of the arguments. There are a couple states where legislators, even if they have a conflict, are required to vote because... legislators say, you know, we can't disrupt our chamber this much. We're designed to be this way. And that's one of the kind of snafus you come into contact with when you're trying to design ethics laws in these states.
Yeah, that makes it difficult if they're only making, what do they make in the state legislature?
$17,000
a year.
But they've also gone gone the opposite direction. I mean, they're, you know, one of the bills we highlighted a couple years ago was a very high up member of the legislature who was in the insurance business pushing a bill that essentially told insurance companies, you have to pay a minimum of X commission to us for selling policies. Now, that's, you know, that's benefiting all insurance agents who sell that, I think it was health insurance, that brand of insurance. So there's no conflict there. But obviously the individual and
no
the people who are
technically
right. Under house rules. But there, you know, obviously there are people in the legislature who are benefiting from that. And you're not eliminating all the votes if you just get rid of the people who are going to benefit.
That is James Salzer, State House reporter for the AJC, and Liz White is a reporter for the Center for Public Integrity. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you,
Celeste.
Coming up, the end of an era for the Savannah Morning News. First, though, all websites are not created equal anymore. The end of net neutrality. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Last month, the Federal Communications Commission repealed net neutrality. Those regulations prohibited broadband providers from blocking websites or charging for higher quality service. But a lot of people still just don't understand what net neutrality is all about. And that means it's time to break it down. Break it down, break it down, baby, because I want y'all all to know. Let me break it down for you. The man who invented the term net neutrality is Tim Wu, a professor at Columbia Law School.
The basic idea is if you pay for the internet, you should have the right to get whatever you want. Mm-hmm. And the phone company and the cable company shouldn't be deciding what that is, whether or not it's pornography, whether or not it's a blog or even downloads of your show.
Okay, but for the internet service providers out there, the ISPs, for them, this is a matter of free speech. They want to be free to charge you for speech.
Right. Their theory.
Why are you against free speech? Why are you against free speech?
Tim Wu says net neutrality is best defined as a network design principle. And the concept is simple. Everything and everybody on the internet should be treated equally. But that's all net neutrality is. Everyone buys an all-access pass. It lets them go anywhere and post anything. Websites are treated equally. Nobody gets an edge on anybody else. Internet service providers, or ISPs for short, say that's not realistic. They say all websites are not equal, and it's ridiculous to pretend they are. Netflix and YouTube are not the same as your Uncle Leroy's fishing blog or your Girl Scout troop's webpage. ISPs want you to think of the internet as a series of roads. The internet was once called an information superhighway, a vast, interconnected series of roads and pathways that take us to billions of virtual destinations, web pages. The idea is anyone can use the roads to go anywhere and expect to get there at the same time. Those roadways and paths are maintained by a very few number of companies, those ISPs, and I mean a few. Most Americans use Verizon, AT&T, Comcast, Time Warner, Cox, or Charter. They all maintain toll roads, and you can go wherever you please once you've paid the toll.
With a Charter price guarantee,
Verizon truly is America's most reliable network.
Switch to Cox.
The fastest, fastest here. Introducing the new Comcast high-speed internet.
But some websites, say Celeste Headley paints with toothpaste.com, get very little traffic, while others get a lot of traffic, like Netflix and its millions of subscribers watching Orange is the New Black.
The animals, the animals, trap, trap, trap.
The ISPs argue these sites are too busy. Very much like our own downtown connector, so often backed up. So what if there were a wide-open toll lane available, which a company's preferred customers, say Netflix, paid extra and charged extra for? That's something like Comcast's plan. They want to charge a site, say Netflix, more money for faster service. The problem is, Netflix would probably pass that cost on to its subscribers. So you'd be the one paying to make sure Star Trek doesn't get stuck buffering. So that's the way the ISPs see it. Now, forget that roadway thing for a moment. Instead, think of the internet as phone lines, or water pipes, or electricity, or any other public utility. Phone companies just create an infrastructure, and they charge you to use it. It may cost more to call Sri Lanka, but it doesn't cost more to get a good line. So if Verizon's signal is weak in your area, you don't pay more for a stronger signal. Instead, you try AT&T or T-Mobile. And that's the argument over net neutrality. It's all about what's fair. Either the internet is a toll road where different people can pay different prices that get them smoother pavement and wider roadways, or the internet is a phone line where everybody pays a fee to use it, but the service is the same quality for everybody, no matter what you're talking about.
In Georgia, the repeal of net neutrality poses a pretty serious threat to health care. In rural parts of the state, telemedicine services are critical for people in those regions. Often those services require a strong and affordable internet connection, and now there's nothing that'll ensure that strong and affordable connection will be there. With me to talk about this is Andy Miller, editor for Georgia Health News. Hello again, Andy.
Good to be here, Celeste.
And by phone, we have Mae Kwong, director with the Center for Connected Health Policy. Hi, Mae.
Good morning.
Andy, what kind of telemedicine services, I mean, you've been on this very show before talking about how telemedicine could be the solution for rural areas where there's no doctors within a reasonable, doctor's offices within a reasonable distance, there's no hospitals within a reasonable distance, certainly no psychologists. So what kind of services require these good connections?
As you said, Celeste, there are many areas of our state that have no mental health providers, and telemedicine is actually delivering telepsychiatry visits that will connect a patient to a remote provider, somebody who could be hundreds of miles away. It works very effectively. You also have situations where in a rural area where, let's say, a senior who's chronically ill and has no transportation, lives at home, an ambulance crew, paramedics could go out to that house with high-resolution cameras and virtual stethoscopes and actually take the vital signs and connect those images to a physician or a nurse practitioner that can be dozens of miles away. And that way, that patient does not have to come out without transportation. That way that patient stays healthy and gets that checkup in their home. And it's working very well. You can have it in schools where a school doesn't have a school nurse, but yet a child can be checked, you know, ear, nose, throat, and through all these cameras and these scopes, these virtual scopes. And you can have patients who get specialty care in a place like Atlanta, like Children's Healthcare. They go back 200 miles away to their home. This way, they can get a follow-up visit with that surgeon in their home or close by their home rather than having to travel all the way back to Atlanta to see that specialist.
So, May, what we're talking about here is that the possibility that internet service providers will charge more for a faster, more reliable connection. If the telemedicine providers can't afford to pay the premium rate, what does that impact? How does that impact the visits that Andy was just talking about?
Well, it can greatly impact it. I mean, without the connectivity, telehealth doesn't work. And you need it actually both on the provider end and the patient end. So depending on where the patient's located, you know, that would depend greatly on if they'll be able to connect. Andy had cited the example of a patient being at home. So it's not just the provider being able to have an affordable connection line. It's also the patient as well if they are doing it from a different location, such as the home.
But if this is just a matter of paying a higher fee, does that make the problem less deadly?
Well, it could price them out. If you're talking about rural health clinics or community health clinics like federally qualified health centers, they don't operate with a lot of money. They operate on very slim margins. So if you increase the price of their connectivity, you're really threatening any telehealth program that they may have or that they may be considering having.
Andy, I want to play you this comment from Ajit Pai. He's the chairman of the FCC. He's responsible largely for the repeal of net neutrality. Here's an interview with Fox News, and he's saying this whole the concern over net neutrality is overblown.
Part of it is that the internet is increasingly important in our daily lives, but more importantly, over the last week at least, that the hysteria and misinformation that's been peddled by some out there is really whipping people up. When you say that democracy is about to be destroyed, that the internet is about to be broken, and this is the guy who's doing it, it shouldn't be a surprise, I think, that some people become alarmed and start doing things like harassing me and my family.
How much attention has this part of net neutrality gotten, this attention to telemedicine, the spread, which has grown rapidly over the past few years of telemedicine, and how much it depends on these internet connections?
There's growing concern in healthcare circles about this particular problem and what this is going to mean. For instance, is the fast lane of connectivity going to be isolated to like celebrity news and Netflix versus medical applications? These medical applications need robust connections. They need strong connections. They need high quality images. But the fear is a small rural health system will not be able, which is struggling really to keep its doors open, they won't be able to afford these fast lanes that the large urban health systems with deep pockets will be able to can afford and certainly will probably go ahead and pay for.
And it's complicated, May, is it not, by what's happening in rural America anyway? We're talking about areas in which there is often concentrated poverty. We're talking about areas in which sometimes it's difficult to get a broadband connection, in which not only have medical locations closed or moved further away, but also there's not always full insurance access as well. And to your mind, how much does net neutrality repeal complicate all of that?
Not only is there full insurance access, there might not be full medical access as well, because you may not have the specialists that are needed in those communities, simply because they're in urban areas as opposed to rural areas. So it creates like even more problems. I mean, that is the reason a lot of these rural health clinics use telehealth, is because they don't have access to that specialty care.
So let me play you then a comment from Scott Meyer. He's with the internet marketing group Nine Clouds, and he's talking about small businesses, and that includes telehealth companies, and why net neutrality is so important for them.
At the end of the day, I see the internet as the lifeline for rural America, for small businesses. The opportunity for us to compete with these large fish is essential, especially because we already know so much of our lives are controlled by the big companies. It'd be a shame if we also have another big fish, the internet service provider, limiting our opportunity.
What are the alternatives, Andy, if some of these places that are relying on telehealth can't afford to pay the premium prices? And as you say, it's impossible to do a follow-up visit if you have an unclear picture, right? Or do a mental health visit if there's buffering. What's the option?
Well, that's a good question, and there isn't much of an option. I mean, telehealth really, on this strong connection, what it does is it keeps health disparities from increasing in rural areas. Rural patients tend to be sicker. They tend to be more uninsured, chronically ill, and living in poverty. And it could be that if we see this repeal play out, as some people fear, that those health disparities will even increase versus what they are today.
May, how would you answer that question? What are the options here should net neutrality? There are some lawmakers, I should say, in Congress, in D.C., who say they're going to pass a law to protect net neutrality. That's a big if at this point. So let's assume net neutrality is the rule going, the loss of net neutrality is permanent. What are the options, May?
Well, the option will be what, you know, they would do if they didn't have telehealth, which is that they would have to send their patients out of the community to get the care that they would need, which, as the recording that you played, somebody had mentioned, it's a lifeline to small businesses. It's literally a lifeline sometimes in a case of a patient. An example I can give you is when a patient has a stroke and there may not be a neurologist in the community. They use telehealth to connect with the neurologist, and where a stroke is concerned, it is literally time is brain cells. So the quicker you can get to a neurologist to help you with that situation, the better the chances are for the patient of surviving without any complications. So if you don't have that telehealth connection, then you are sending that patient on however long of a journey it is, and you're costing them brain cells.
And any idea how many communities are relying on telehealth or are relying on internet connections at this point in Georgia?
It's a growing number, Celeste. It's almost the whole state. We don't have complete extensive use of telemedicine, and we still have room to grow, but I can tell you the communities that use it are very happy with it. Both from the patient point of view and the provider point of view.
And May, there have been discussions nationally about using telehealth to bridge the gap in a lot of areas all around the country. Do those discussions now stop? Does the growth of telehealth end because of this net neutrality ruling?
That's the question. I mean, it's in some ways a bit in conflict with some of the recent policies that other federal agencies have been trying to promote. For example, the VA, who have been trying to promote doing telehealth within the home. You have a patient in the home. How do you assure that they have a strong enough connection that they can afford? Because you need that connectivity at both ends. What happens to those types of policies? Medicare, they've also been looking at trying to do more telehealth in the home as well. What happens with those policies and those issues?
And May, does it matter if one side has a good connection and the other doesn't? In other words, let's say that the hospital gets a break on their ISP fees, right? So they have a really good connection, but a poor rural resident doesn't. Does that then also sort of ruin the chance for good telehealth?
It could. I mean, if they don't have, the thing with telehealth is, and I think Andy touched upon this, is that if you don't have a good connection, you're not going to have people who want to use telehealth. You're not going to have a provider because they're going to feel like they can't rely on the image that came through or the interaction that came through because it wasn't clear enough. And you're going to have a patient who's frustrated and believe the technology doesn't work. So you're going to need that connectivity and that good, strong connection on both ends.
So, Andy, who's making this case? What happens next? Who's making this argument to Georgia lawmakers and in D.C.?
Well, I think, as you explained earlier, net neutrality is something that's hard for people to grasp, but you broke it down very well. I think that there is some talk about exempting health care from this repeal, which I think would be an excellent step here, and it would solve a lot of these problems.
Except it doesn't help the person, right? If they're connecting to them at home, you still have the person's home system subject to possibly higher fees.
And I think that this needs to be straightened out. I mean, if you're talking about being an advocate for rural health care improvement, I mean, I think that this repeal could really be damaging.
That's Andy Miller. He's the editor for Georgia Health News. And we also spoke with Mae Kwong. She's director for the Center for Connected Health Policy. Mae and Andy, thank you both so much.
Great to be here.
Coming up, a tribute to the Madison Morgan Cultural Center. And we'll do an exit interview with a guy who's been writing columns in Savannah for nearly four decades. This is On Second Thought. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. When Tom Barton started work as a reporter in Savannah, the newsroom was filled with cigarette smoke and electric typewriters. Jimmy Carter was president, and a dozen eggs cost 48 cents. 39 years later, the longtime opinion page editor is retiring, and his last day with the Savannah Morning News is this week. Congratulations, Tom, first of all.
Thank you, Celeste.
The first question everyone has to be asking you is, what do you plan to do now, right?
Well, a buddy of mine down here, Tony Field, who said if I mentioned his name on the radio, he'd give me $20, told me.
You just made $20, Tom Barton.
I know. He said, here's what you do when you retire. You have a nice two or three Bloody Marys at breakfast, then you go home, you plan for a nice long lunch, you eat a lot of food at lunch, then go home and take a nap. Then you get up about 4:30 and look for a good early bird special dinner.
Well, after three Bloody Marys, I think I would be ready for a nap. But let me go back to when you first started in Savannah. When you took the job, how long did you plan to stay?
Only 2 or 3 years. Well, originally just 2 or 3 weeks. I needed to make some money to make a deposit for my downtown apartment. I needed $175, and I needed to make...
And that was going to take you 3 weeks to earn.
Yes. I started out at $185 a week. I was offered a job at $175 a week at a paper in Anderson, South Carolina. But I'm a University of Georgia graduate, and I know how to add and subtract. I know my numbers. So
you figured out that $185 was more than $175.
Absolutely.
Very smart. Yeah. So when did you move over from being a reporter to being the op-ed page editor?
About 15 years ago.
And tell me about that transition, because I'm not sure that maybe people outside of journalism don't realize what a big difference that is when you go from being a reporter who's concerned about the appearance of objectivity to someone who's working in op-eds and is allowed to express their opinion.
Yes, huge. I can't say how big it is. It's a whole new different way of thinking. Reporters, like you said, they have to be objective, but we know privately, reporters do have opinions, but they're trained, the professional ones are trained to keep opinions out of their reporting. But when you're an opinion writer, you have to have opinions. Well, you don't have to, but the good opinion writers have opinions, and you have to write persuasively, and to do a good job at that, you have to have the command of the facts. You just can't, I mean, all opinions are not created equally. But as a reporter, you're trained to keep your own personal feelings out of a story. Opinion writers, when you're arguing a certain point of view, you have to have the command of the facts to write persuasively. And I looked at it as kind of a lawyer arguing before a jury, like his closing arguments. You have to have all your facts in the law, and you put the best, I hate to use the word spin, but you're trying to persuade people to your point of view, so you have to have good command of the facts and be able to write persuasively. And that's hard to do. I mean, reporters, they've got a very difficult job too. And in some ways, reporting is the bread and butter of this business. I mean, nowadays, everybody has opinions and you can go on the internet and get any opinion you want. But as we know, not all opinions are, worth reading because of either the work or lack of work that was put into arriving at those opinions. But it was hard to move from reporting to opinion writing.
Yeah, it's a complete culture change almost. I wanted to ask you about some changes in the news business that have hit your paper. The Savannah Morning News was sold to Gatehouse Media last year. At the time we spoke to Carolyn Carlson, she's an associate professor of communications at Kennesaw State, and we asked her about what's driving all of the newspaper consolidations around the country.
The Morris Papers were the last family-owned newspaper chain in Georgia still in existence. All the rest of the family-owned newspapers, at least the dailies, had been sold already to big chains. It seems like the only way to survive is as a big chain where you have economies of scale that keep things affordable.
I wonder what your take is on this, having been in the business spanning from these smaller owned papers to now. She's saying that you kind of have to have a large conglomeration in order to keep a paper alive. How do you feel about that?
Well, I understand it completely financially, but part of me is sad because I like the family-owned papers. They're close to their community, and once you have a corporate headquarters 1,000 miles away, I think you lose a certain amount of immediacy with your community. It's all about covering your community. And I think family-owned papers, by and large, do a pretty good job at that, because the owners of the paper, you run into them at the grocery store, at church, or at your kids' Little League baseball games, and you can talk to them and tell them what you think about their newspaper. It's hard to do that with a corporate.
Do people find you in the grocery store and tell you what they think about your last column?
Absolutely. I'll go to the Publix grocery store and I'll go through the checkout line. The guy bagging my groceries will look at me kind of sideways, like I've got two heads. And he goes, "Aren't you that guy that works at the paper?" And I'll kind of look back at him kind of the same way, like, "Well, why do you want to know that for?"
Do you ever deny it?
No.
So what have been the biggest stories, do you think? What kind of news town is Savannah?
Oh, Savannah has always been a great news city. I started out as a police reporter, and I hate to say it, but we've always had crime issues down here that we can't seem to get rid of. But unfortunately, some of the big stories I remember involve tragedies and accidents, like the sugar refinery explosion down here in 2008 that killed 13 people. That one still sticks out in my mind is the most recent big story, because it involved a certain amount of corporate negligence. They did not keep that plant up to snuff, so to speak, with the sugar dust, and it exploded one horrible night. And I happened to be that same night at a library gala trying to raise money for the public libraries, and we heard that the plant had blown up. And I was at the gala with some of my TV friends, and the TV guy, of course, he had to leave right away, and he was supposed to be the auctioneer at this gala, so they volunteered me to take his place.
And, do you want to give us a sample? Or
no, I don't think I raised a lot of money that night, unfortunately. But I later went out there, and it looked like somebody had dropped an atomic bomb on that sugar refinery. It was just bloody awful. And all those poor people that were trapped inside there with the burns and the people that were killed. I mean, that was a tragedy. But I remember, I say, back on the police beat, you know, you remember all the horrible murders. But the hardest part, to my mind, was talking to the families of victims. And I never got over that. That kind of tears at your soul after a while. And I only lasted 2 years as a police reporter, because you begin to get hardened. And I think once you start losing your humanity, it's time to move on to something else. So I went from covering the criminals and the cops to a higher class of criminals, politicians.
So there are people now, Tom, who have wondered if newspapers should get rid of their opinion pages, because there's confusion among readers who read opinions on the opinion page and think that means a paper is biased. In the 2 minutes that we have left, what do you think about this debate?
I think opinion writing is what separates newspapers from other news organizations, because we have people that we're trained to do this every day, to look at our communities and hopefully come up with opinions of how we can improve our community or improve our state. And I understand why people think that, but we have at the newspaper where I work at, we've always had a wall between the newsroom and the opinion page people. It's like church and state were separate. I don't tell the newsroom what to put on the front page. and they don't tell me who to endorse for mayor or governor. And I think the problem in Georgia and most communities nowadays is apathy. People are tuned out to politics, and I can understand that because this politics, and that's another thing that's changed. Politics statewide and nationwide and in communities have gotten so polarized that people are just sickened by all this stuff. And I even get headaches thinking about, you know, what happened in Washington lately, what's going on in Georgia, or even down at City Hall here in Savannah. And it's easy to tune out to that, but you can't do that because our democracy rests on an informed electorate. And I don't want to make this a civics lesson, but I think newspapers have a vital role in their community to engage the public in political issues and opinions. And I know some people, especially if you disagree with them, they'll call you up and say, why are you telling me who to vote?
Or they'll find you in Publix, right?
Well, yeah.
That is Tom Barton. He's the outgoing opinion page editor for the Savannah Morning News. Tom, congratulations and thank you.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it.
Many historic Georgia theaters need repairs. Several months ago, the Fox Theater Institute shared nearly $500,000 with more than a dozen theaters around the state. One recipient, the Madison Morgan Cultural Center in Madison, Georgia. Filmmaker Jesse Freeman credits the center with shaping his love of filmmaking.
Hey, everybody, gather around, it's Madison time. Give me a big, strong line.
My name is Jesse Freeman. I'm a filmmaker based in Brooklyn, New York. I grew up in Madison, Georgia, mostly in the 80s. I was born in 78, and there was and still is no movie theater in town. There's no cinema. It's a very small town. So my primary exposure to seeing films live and in person was at the Madison Morgan Cultural Center.
Reverse that bird. Step back over.
The building was built, I believe, as a graded schoolhouse. It was a public school, and it operated as a school until sometime in the 1950s. From the 1950s until the mid-70s, it stood dormant. I mean, it was decaying. And a group of folks decided to raise money to renovate it and create a cultural center, a place where there could be performing arts and mixed-use museum space. And this happened in 1976. So they were a good decade ahead of the game in historic preservation in the Southeast.
To the back, into the M, erase it, give me an I, dot it, rock it back into the Madison when I say it.
I probably walked into the Cultural Center at 6 or 7 years old. I remember my brother and I saw The Lady and the Tramp.
Uh-huh. Okay. Hey, Joe. Butcher, he says that he wants two spaghetti speciale, heavy on the meatball.
I remember the scene where they're eating the spaghetti and the Lady and the Tramp sort of come together and kiss after they've shared that same noodle. I remember, you know, that was it's what passes for a heated scene for a, you know, a little kid. I remember that scene probably more than any other.
Oh, this is the night. It's a beautiful night. And we call it a bella notte.
They had a summer children's film series. And my mother would take my brother and I to see these films. And it's really sort of where I fell in love with films.
It happened on one of them zippity-doo-dah days. Now, that's the kind of day when you can't open your mouth without a song jump right out of it. Zippity-doo-dah, zippity-ay.
I remember once going to see The Song of the South, which even then was still just carried so much controversy around it. This is the Disney Uncle Remus film, and I remember my mother trying to explain to me sort of the complexity of it.
Yes, sir. Zip
Uncle Remus is this character that Joel Chandler Harris created that is sort of like a vestige of post-slavery, an old African-American man that would tell these stories that I believe are based on African folk tales. The film itself deals with an actual character of Uncle Remus.
Out of the singing heart of the Old South come the timeless tales of Uncle Remus, forever fresh and new, sparkling with enchanting fantasy. This is motion picture storytelling at its best.
You know, there's a lot of controversy that dealt with Joel Chandler Harris having a lot of success with those stories that were appropriated from an African-American that was on the land that his family owned. Joel Chandler Harris grew up in Putnam County, and the library that my family went to as a kid, and the library that I go back to when I'm back in Madison, Georgia, is part of the Uncle Remus Regional Library System. So I had always seen like statues and paintings of the Br'er Rabbit characters. I mean, these were characters that were very familiar to me, and all these stories were very familiar to me. So seeing them on the big screen didn't seem that unusual to me.
Raymond Andrews was an American author from Georgia.
When time and money permits, I make documentary films as well.
He had authored 6 books, all of them set in the South, all of them dealing with issues of race, identity, family, and perseverance.
The film I made about Raymond Andrews aired on Georgia Public Broadcasting in 2010, I believe it was. The Cultural Center partnered with the African American Museum in Madison, and they did a screening of the Raymond Andrews film, which was very flattering. I flew down there and talked a little bit afterward. There was a good turnout. It was neat to me because that's the place where I grew up watching films. I mean, that's the movie, that was my movie theater when I was a kid. And then to have my own film screened there many years later was a special experience.
That's filmmaker Jesse Freeman recalling his visits to the Madison Morgan Cultural Center. That story was produced by GPB's Sean Powers. The Fox Theater Institute in Atlanta awarded the Madison Theater a grant to repair and replace its seating fabric. And that's our show for today, but we would love to hear from you about a historic building in your neighborhood. Is there a building near you that you would like to see restored? Call us at 404-500-9457. You can also post on Facebook or Twitter. For today, that's On Second Thought. From GPB News, I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.